Much of western Montana is under severe thunderstorm watches or warnings. Good evening, I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. And weather tops our news story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also have fire updates on fires. And Capitol reporter Dan Boyce profiles the life and accomplishments of the late Gordon Belcourt. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with Montana filmmakers Alex and Andrew Smith about the debut of their new film, Winter in the Blood. Much of western and central Montana is under either a severe thunderstorm watch or warning this evening, as a strong system of storm cells has moved into the area. A severe thunderstorm watch remains in effect in northwestern Montana and east central Idaho until 10 p.m. tonight. The storm is moving from the Gold Creek area to central Powell County with damaging winds around 60 miles per hour, 1-inch hail, and lightning. Another severe thunderstorm watch is in effect for Missoula, Lake, Lincoln, Powell, Silverbow, Lewis and Clark, Ravalli, Cascade, Flathead, and Sanders counties. We'll have the complete forecast later on in this broadcast.
Our stormy weather has firefighters on the West Mullen Fire near Superior keeping a close eye on the changing conditions. Over 400 firefighters, including six hotshot crews, are fighting the 1,800-acre blaze. Information Officer Pat McKelvey says they're tracking several storm cells that have moved into the fire area this afternoon.
There are places back up in here on these ridge tops that, you know, If the wrong kind of fire behavior were there, we're just not going to let it get to that situation. Let's put it that way. We're not going to put these people, continue to put them in harm's way.
The fire, which started Sunday, has burned nearly 3 square miles and still has some residents out of their homes. Some of the burned acreage is due to burnouts set by fire crews trying to protect houses west of town. The Gold Creek fire burning just north of Missoula has grown to 160 acres. A Type 2 incident management team has taken control of the fire. They're establishing safety zones and anchor points and also keeping an eye on the stormy weather.
In another news from around the state, Missoula has joined New Orleans, Minneapolis, Austin, Atlanta, and 54 other cities across the county that recognize domestic partnerships on a municipal level. Ruth Eddy has more on how the registry open to all Montanans will work.
The Domestic Partnership Registry will be housed in the Missoula City Clerk's office and taken care of by Missoula City Clerk Marty Rabine.
It won't be an actual book that we write in. We haven't done those sorts of registries for a really long time.
The register, like most records, will be kept in a spreadsheet in City Hall. While an Excel sheet is a bit underwhelming, Rabine is looking to make the process a little more tangible.
I'm looking at doing a certificate and some cards to send back to the registrants so that they'll have something to keep in their wallet and something to keep in their records to.
Missoula City Council member Caitlin Cobble, who's openly gay herself, sponsored the referendum that passed unanimously on Monday night.
Gay people in committed, you know, lifelong relationships are treated like strangers under the law in Montana, and I think that that's just wrong. And so at least now we have something that says, no, you know, the city of Missoula recognizes our relationship.
Cobble says having the city's recognition can help same-sex couples, especially in emergency or insurance matters. The city can't mandate how the insurance companies operate, but if they do have an inclusive healthcare plan, the registry could be the official documentation they need.
The couple could come down to Missoula register and be able to present this certificate, you know, like they would a marriage license or a state domestic partnership.
The registry is not exclusive to same-sex couples. Rabine recalls a recent call from a heterosexual couple interested in registering.
They're employer offers benefits to domestic partners, but they need to establish proof.
Rabine says that while the registry is very practical,
it also has some symbolic meaning in terms of recognizing the dignity of a relationship.
The Human Rights Campaign, a national gay rights organization, rates communities on a 100-point equality scale. Missoula, along with Billings, Great Falls, and Helena, will be looked at this fall. Missoula's new registry is worth 12 points. Cobble says being openly gay and on city council scores another 3. When she checked last before the new registry, Missoula was in the high 80s. She's hoping to be the 12th city to get a perfect score.
I just think that would be awesome and knock the socks off a lot of people because no one thinks of Montana as, you know, being necessarily a leader in LGBT equality. But I think that, you know, Missoula really is, and we're doing some awesome work here.
Cobble will be speaking at a Victory Fund event this weekend in Seattle. The Victory Fund helps elect LGBT leaders to change policy. For Montana Evening Edition, I'm Ruth Eddy.
One of the Rocky Mountain West's most influential Native American leaders has died. Gordon Belcourt was executive director of the Montana-Wyoming Tribal Leaders Council from 1998 until his death on Monday in Billings. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says Belcourt was known for building the organization into a powerful regional voice on Native issues, especially public health.
Gordon Belcourt's daughter Annie says her father's traditional Blackfeet tribal name means mixed iron boy.
And in Blackfeet, that is pronounced Meekskamikskamapi.
A name given to him by his great uncle after he had just returned from World War II in 1945. A name that reflects strength. And Annie says he carried that essence with him through his life. Raised in poverty on the Blackfeet Reservation, the oldest of nine children, Gordon Belcourt graduated valedictorian from Browning High School. He attended the University of Santa Clara in California, became a second lieutenant in the U.S. Army, attended the University of Montana Law School before changing his mind and getting his master's in public health from UC Berkeley.
He dedicated his life to, you know, volunteer work, to helping his community, to really helping his family and any Native person, regardless of what tribe they came from, if they're enrolled or not enrolled. His priority was the health of Indian babies, Indian moms, Indian dads, Indian families.
After his master's, Belcourt worked in Missoula and back home on the Blackfeet Reservation. In 1998, he took over as executive director of the Montana-Wyoming Tribal Leaders Council in Billings. The organization was nearly bankrupt, had one employee. Now, it's a force. Here's Senator John Tester.
Because of his hard work, they have a tremendous amount of clout.
A unified voice of the 10 federally recognized tribes in Montana and Wyoming. Tester says he worked with Belcourt on infrastructure projects, the Tribal Law and Order Act, and permanently reauthorizing the Indian Health Care Improvement Act, an act Tester says hadn't been passed in many years.
Made a real difference in Indian country and made a real difference, I think, in quality of life for those folks who needed those health care services. Obviously, that issue isn't entirely solved yet. We still have our challenges, and that's moving forward. That's where I'm really going to miss Gordon Belcourt, because he was the kind of leader that looked for solutions.
Belcourt's staff at the Montana-Wyoming Tribal Leaders Council describe him as a mentor who led by example. They say late in life, he put much of his focus into water rights issues and trying to lower rates of alcoholism and suicide on reservations. Program manager Bethany Fatupaito.
He was very passionate about what he did, and he had a strong heart for those that he was fighting for.
UC Berkeley named Belcourt a public health hero in 2003. The University of Montana awarded him an honorary doctorate in 2007. Daughter Annie Belcourt, one of Gordon's nine children, Annie says her father had been ill for several months prior to his death. He believes strongly in his traditional Blackfeet faith, that dying is only a door to another chapter. In a YouTube interview posted last December, Gordon Belcourt said, in that faith, the relationship between an individual and the tribe is of critical importance.
So if you as an individual being raised a certain way by your parents and grandparents and the tribe do something that in the eye of the Creator is positive, then everybody's beneficiary of that. And anything that has a place in our world has power and has essence. And so you treat everything with respect.
Gordon Belcourt died Monday in Billings. He was 68 years old. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
The new Montana-made film, Winter in the Blood, received a warm reception at its recent premiere at the Los Angeles Film Festival and will have its Montana premiere this Saturday evening in Missoula. The film is based on the acclaimed novel by the late Montana author James Welch, who was a family friend of the film's directors, brothers Alex and Andrew Smith. Both the novel and the movie give a harsh but authentic portrait of growing up on Montana's Blackfeet Reservation and the High Line, where it was filmed. In tonight's feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talks with Alex and Andrew Smith about their desire to make the film as true to the novel as possible.
We felt very, very much like we wanted to do our best to translate the essence of the novel to the screen.
And we wanted to be as brave as the book is. That was one of our goals to ourselves. Don't flinch, you know.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Don't pull punches. Go at things just like Welch did. And really try to figure out a cinematic equivalent of of the way he works with the words on the page.
Some of the words are directly from the novel, aren't they? There was a great line, "I was as distant from myself as the hawk from the moon." Those are lines taken straight out of the novel.
Yeah, it was very hard to resist a lot of the language in the novel.
Because it's so beautiful.
Because it's poetic and precise and, very, very original, and it's just his voice. And one of the largest elements of our work on the film was figuring out how much and how little to use a voiceover, because, you do want to go into it. And also we made up, a lot. We also try to work in his voice. And Chaske, our lead actor, was able to sometimes find the equivalency.
And he's blessed with a great voice. He's got a great set of pipes, doesn't he? For a young man, very deep and melodious voice, I think. Pleasure to listen to, just if you're just not even listening to the meaning of the words, but just the tone of his voice.
Yeah, Chaske, wonderful, wonderful actor, wonderful human being. And his voice is very... it's interesting because he's in character in all his voiceover, and he was recording that. We would send him lines while we were in the edit to stitch something together or to explain something, and he would go to his apartment in Williamstown
in Williamsburg
in Brooklyn, and turn off the lights, lay down on the floor, and record it on his iPhone, and then email them to us, and we'd slap them up on the screen, see if they worked, so that when we actually got into the full-on final sound recording, he was prepared, we were prepared, and he actually changed some lines because there are certain things that we couldn't access as well as him because he was in the skin of that character and because he's Native American. So Chaske had a voice in some of the voiceover lines. They're either Jim or Chaske's mostly.
The style of the film is to interweave the past and the present throughout the film, and that is done so beautifully. And in part, it's not only you as the writers and directors deciding how that should be done, but your cinematographer had to figure that out as well.
And I think, to give him credit, our editor, because some of that we figured out, in our conversations with Paola, our DP, and on the set, figuring out transitions so that we had the camera transitions, but other ones came to us in the edit room where it didn't necessarily work the way we had intended, and we found another spot for the flashback or the memory scene. So, but it was a really complicated three-man weave.
Yeah. The movie goes between the past and the present and what we call the other, which is things that are happening that may or not be real, that our main character is experiencing, and it might be sort of delusion based on alcohol, based on his own repression and his own dreams and needs, and sort of a modern day vision quest.
So adventures in the spirit world,
yeah. Exactly. So to balance those three elements, now, then, and other, took a lot of braiding and unbraiding and trying things out and moving things around. So when we were shooting, there was sort of a discussion with our cinematographer, Paolo Widobro, about how we shoot those different worlds. We didn't want any of them to be, too nostalgic or too golden. We also didn't want them to be too, drained of color, too depressed. So it was a little more subtle than that. But each of those three strands does have a different look to it. But as Andrew was saying, our editor, Michael Hoffaker, worked really hard to make it flow like the book does, in and out of present tense, in and out of consciousness. And he came up with a couple of style things for us, especially some of the recovered memory of the night before, where we were piecing the night together slowly. And that's some of that's in the book. Some of it was in the script, but a lot of it came in the edit.
There are so many great performances in the film. Chaske, of course, as the lead character, is fantastic, I think. But the others, there are almost too many to mention, but I'll just mention a few of my favorites, and that's Saginaw Grant's portrayal as Yellow Calf.
Saginaw is a remarkable person, and and a honored actor and a leader. He's a spokesperson. He's got
old is he now? He must be.
He's not as old as he seems in the film, but he's ancient in some ways, and in other ways he's very spry. He was wonderful, and we hadn't worked with him before. He came to us vis-a-vis our casting director, Renee, and he was one of those guys where as soon as we saw the audition, we're like,
yeah. And Saginaw's face is like it's epic. You know, it's like you can see so many stories written on the skin with him. So that was just useful already. But then he turned out to be so compelling on screen. And he added, there's a touch in the movie, I don't want to spoil it, but there's something that is a big moment, and that was Saginaw's idea of sort of a reveal of who he is in relationship to
letting his hair down a bit.
Letting his hair down, yes, mm-hmm. Exactly. And it was something that we hadn't written, something that we didn't know about, and we were talking about him being a man of the woods, so having his hair down, and he's like, I wouldn't have my hair down unless I was grieving. And it was like, aha, that was an aha moment. We're like, well, okay, well now we know when you might want to let your hair
very,
down.
And powerful.
Yeah. And yeah. So that was like one of those things, you cast the right guy and they take it somewhere that you never could have imagined.
There are a lot of Native American actors, primarily Native American actors, in the film. What has been their reaction to see the finish product?
We did show the film to the Native American Literary Symposium, which was a gathering of people who teach Native American literature. Most of those scholars are Native or First Nations, and it went over great. That was a very scary audience. I was like, wow, we're showing the movie to the people who teach the book and who are also Native, and so that was pretty daunting on both sides. But it actually, they liked how we made the film, and they like how it ended up.
And were you asking also what were the actors on
response? Yeah, and the actors themselves.
At the LA Film Festival, we were lucky in that Saginaw, who lives in Southern California, was able to come, and Casey Camp, who plays Teresa, who's terrific, was there. And, of course, Lily Gladstone came down, and Chaskay, and a number of other actors.
And Julia Jones.
And Julia. And one of the most honored moments I've felt was actually hearing hearing Saginaw and Casey and Lily speak about the sense of authenticity that they felt in the film, that it worked for them. Saginaw was very articulate about that, and that to me was the most strongest praise that I personally can take away from this. You know,
and I would just say that Andrew and I and our third writer Ken White, none of us being Native American, we had to rely on our cast to teach us and to lead us in certain regards about the film. And Lily Gladstone and Chaskay were really great guides in getting it right.
I think Montanans, when they see the film, are going to be struck by its authenticity, too.
We hope
so. To me, it really just, this is so Montana.
we hope so very much. We believe very strongly in sort of the Richard Hugo idea of the more specific you are about your hometown, the more universal and evocative it becomes to everybody. That's a great, instead of trying to be generic, you try to be very specific, and it'll actually trigger other people's hometowns is the idea. We also wanted to honor the book, which is I think a Montana treasure, and there was pressure to shoot the film in Canada. There was pressure to cast non-Native actors, but that was not the way to do this movie, and so we did it this way. And so we're very excited to show it to a Montana audience. Some Montana came down to LA, which was great. And the Montana Film Office has been extremely helpful all through the process, especially at this late stages. And they're helping us with this screening, too.
The film is, of course, about two brothers who grow up with losing their father when they're quite young. So, of course, all of us who know you two think of that as well when we see the film. We think of your personal biography and how that has to have informed the film so much.
Well, I'm sure it's what attracted us on some subconscious level to the material, in addition to our friendship with Jim and our interest in the subject matter. But I think that Alex and I are drawn to these stories of survival, you know, of survival and certainly of loss, but transcending loss, I think, is a common theme in the work that we find ourselves doing. I mean, it would be fun for us to write a film in which there's no dead fathers, but it'll have to be the next one.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way we could access the story was to access that which was universal. So it was about a person who has a very connected to their brother, about a person who loses their father, about a person who grows up isolated and feeling like, you know, they're missing out on something and looking for that and searching for that and searching for it in some wrong ways and dealing with their trauma or not dealing with their trauma, not dealing with their grief in a healthy way. And that being a sort of a an okay medicine for a while, but at some point it stops working. And the movie's about when that stops working, when you, if you haven't actually fully dealt with your loss in a healthy way.
I think that comes back to that sense of place and of land and of, you know, certainly in the novel and I think in the film, home is a very complicated concept for the main character. What is home? How can home feel so torturous and so many things and still be the place that creates solace? And I think that that is the exploration of that character and where he ends up at the, you know, in his discovery throughout the film is that that home is carried around, you know, inside him, and that the concept of place is so deeply in the bones, which is echoed, I think, in all of Jim's writing, and certainly that sense of place is what we were after.
It's an excellent film, and we could talk about it for days on end, and I know people will be talking about it after they've seen it, and it will premiere this Saturday in Missoula, the Roxy Theater. There are three showings. Those two are sold out, but the 9:45 showing is still open.
Yeah, the newly refurbished Roxy, this is the first that we saw movies as kids. We didn't have a TV, so we used to come in and see movies at the Roxy and the Crystal and
the Fox
and the World and the Woman. But so I'm really delighted to be playing at the Roxy and in this new iteration. In the 9:45 screening, we just added, and so there should still be tickets available. That's last I heard.
And Andrew, it will be shown again in Missoula sometime in the future. This won't be the one and only time, obviously, and hopefully it will be shown around the world at some point.
We are, you know, we it'll have a strong Montana set of screenings later this fall, and obviously we will want it to get both on campus and off campus. We'll screen it here in Missoula. There's a lot of interest in the film across the state, which is great, and I think throughout the Northwest. And we've been invited to a number of festivals, both in North America so far. So we'll be traveling with it a bit this fall as well, and then we'll see what happens with it. We're very encouraged by the reception so far.
This is a sneak preview, kind of. It's more of a thank you to Montana. Before we took it out on the road and took it to a lot of places, we really felt indebted to the support we got from Montana and from the communities of Missoula and the Highline. So we wanted to do a little sort of little splash of the movie, and we definitely will bring it back once we have our distribution sort of cycle in place.
And we will definitely be bringing it to Haver. There's a lot of people up there who are like, wait a minute, why are we showing it? You're showing it everywhere, but no, it's going to go. I mean, we'll be going up there in the High Line where it started.
And I've been speaking with Andrew and Alex Smith. They are the directors and writers of the new film Winter in the Blood, based on James Welch's fantastic novel. And congratulations on the film. I think it's a huge success.
Oh, thank you so much, Sally. We've felt so encouraged by all the interest that, you know, has been shown by this community, including here at KUFM.
In tonight's weather forecast for west of the Divide, severe thunderstorm watch is in effect until 10 p.m. this evening for the Kootenai region, West Glacier region, Flathead Mission Valleys, the lower Clark Fork region, Missoula Bitterroot Valleys, Bitterroot Sapphire Mountains, Butte Blackfoot region, and the Sealy Lake region. Lows will be in the upper 40s to mid 50s. Tomorrow will be sunny with highs in the mid 80s to lower 90s. For central Montana, severe thunderstorm watch is in effect until 10 p.m. this evening for the Rocky Mountain Front, Eastern Glacier, Hill, Cascade, Shoto, Central and Southern Lewis and Clark, Toole, Liberty, Eastern Ponderay, Eastern Teton, and Judith Basin, with lows around 55 to 65 degrees. Tomorrow will be sunny with highs in the mid-80s. And for southwest Montana, severe thunderstorm watch is in effect until 10 p.m. this evening for all of southwest Montana. Tonight, expect mostly cloudy skies with thunderstorms and lows around the upper 50s. Tomorrow calls for sunny skies with a slight chance of thunderstorms in the afternoon, highs in the upper 80s. And now for the editorial comments of Mark Hansen.
What do you feel when you enter a place where grizzly bears live? It's probably not a comfortable or common feeling for most people. I'm guessing because we're not used to perceiving ourselves the potential victim of an animal's aggression. Grizzlies are magnificent because of their sheer size, speed, power, and capacity to do us harm should an encounter with them go wrong. The idea, however unlikely, that we might even be food for such creatures is unnerving. But this very experience can also be morally instructive. The fact that life depends upon other life takes us to the heart of wildness and our connection to it. Author Jack Turner captured this well, quote, "The moose incorporates the willow, taking the life of the willow into its own life, making the wildness of the willow reincarnate. I kill the moose, its body feeds the willow, and the grouse whortleberries where it dies. It feeds my body, and in feeding my body, the willow and the moose feed the 1 billion bacteria that inhabit 3 inches of my colon, the 1 million spirochetes that live in my mouth. This great feeding body is the world. It evolved together, mutually, all interdependent, all interrelating ceaselessly, the dust of old stars hurtling through time." End quote. The term wild is related to the idea of being self-willed. Wild animals, plants, and ecosystems do what they do by the laws of their natures. And we, as Turner reminds us, owe our existence to the wild. Wildness is within, lacking boundaries to the wildness without. It is found in the self-regulating organism that is our body, dependent on the other wild beings of the earth. This self-regulation plays out in the cycles of life, decay, death, and out of death, new life. Each of us participates in this universal reality of wild nature, whether grizzly bears remind us of it or not. And yet, we also seem to have a contradiction within ourselves. Wildness makes us uneasy, and we are governed not merely by the laws of nature, but also by free choices, including the choice to control nature and to deny our relationship with it. This choice has become, unfortunately, a hallmark of what we call civilization. Much of our Western tradition reflects this tension between accepting and denying the wild. The ancient Greeks recognized it, as well as its potential for tragedy. They saw that we have an aspect of ourselves reflected by the god Apollo, who represented reason, the individual, and light. And yet they also saw the humanity in the god Dionysus, who represented the emotional, the primal, the dynamic energies of the cycle of life and death, and the dark. The human impulse is to wall off the latter, to stay safe in our cities, and to call these wilder aspects of ourselves immoral. The wild is the savage, the uncivilized, they thought. The way to avoid tragedy was to keep wildness out of our cities and out of ourselves. But the Greek tragic writer Euripides saw that the arrogant attempts to deny wildness was the real source of tragedy. Wildness must be respected or denied at our own peril. And most religious traditions have centered around the idea that to live is to participate in the universal truth that new life is always resurrected from death, and that we participate in that reality all the time, whether we like it or not. That's why experiencing a place with grizzly bears, like Glacier National Park or the Bob Marshall Wilderness Area, is not only a moral but a religious experience. These are the places where we can learn again that the tragedy of our times is the catastrophic elimination of wildness from our world, reflected in the war on wolves, mass species extinction, unfettered consumption, and human-caused climate change. And we can learn again that if we are to understand ourselves more truly, we need to see ourselves as intimately related to this wild world. Then we can act, and not only work to preserve the wild places we have left, but also to envision how to transform our ways of life within our civilizations, showing a greater respect for the wild and our place in it. How we do that is the conversation we should have after we've spent time in the lands of the grizzly bears. This is Mark Hansen, guest commentator for the Mansfield Program in Ethics and Public Affairs at the University of Montana.
Mark Hansen is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening, and please join us tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.